So I would like to offer some reflections tonight. And I'm also really enjoying sitting in silence with you right now. And my mind says, but you're supposed to say something. Because you're a teacher for the next 50 minutes. Says so on the schedule. Says so on our plan. And maybe we can start with the silence. You might be thinking, oh, I've had plenty of silence, or not enough silence. But what I was struck by in just waiting to begin was I desire to share something with you. I have been reflecting, in fact, a little bit about desire and a few other things, mindfulness. And I desire to share something with you. And I think I probably will. And the silence is also my desire. I also have a love affair with the silence and the way it seems to call me home. But as I sense that home isn't mean that I never say anything. My humblest wish would be to serve that love as close as I can. To speak from as close as I can to what I love. And that is sometimes more or less possible. I don't have to be perfect at it. Perhaps there's no perfect at it. Perhaps it keeps calling us to newer, deeper relationship and possibilities. I'm wondering if any of you, maybe you wouldn't put it that way, maybe you would. Do any of you have a love affair with anything about being here? Maybe those senses of possibility that call you onward despite all the hardships that being on retreat also seems to entail. Maybe you wouldn't call it a love affair, maybe you would. Maybe you'd be too shy to call it a love affair, maybe it's a love-hate relationship. But what I think I could say with some conviction is that wherever we go in this path, wherever you go, if I use that language of going for now, whatever you open to, whatever you are called to, is going to be dependent on your skill and relationship with desire. And by path here, I don't only mean our meditative path, I mean our life, our soul's journey, our way we engage. Your relationship with desire, anybody's relationship with desire, is key in shaping our mind, in shaping our action, in shaping our world. And desire is not necessarily good or bad. It always arises in a context with many other factors, with many other conditioning factors. Hopefully I'll say something about that. But nothing can happen without desire. And when we study the mind and perception and the co-arising of our way of attending with what arises, we see that there's no single perception, from the grossest to the most subtle, that occurs without desire. We can't love without desire. We can't act without desire. You wouldn't have got to this retreat without some desire. We can't engage in a project without desire. Desire, it is what makes things, right? Makes things come into fruition. But we also know desire is some things that come into fruition. You know, some actions, some results of our desire aren't so helpful. We see that, and, you know, sometimes we can be suspicious of desire, rightly so. In the Buddha Dharma, the second noble truth is there is craving, and craving is the cause of suffering. And we say, yeah, I see that. I see the generation of all that wanting, whether it's spiritual wanting, worldly wanting, human wanting, anything wanting. I can see that that can lead in all kinds of directions. So if I act it out and there's no wisdom, well, if I push it away, if I push my desire away and there's no wisdom, that's also pretty damaging. I don't know if any of you have been in that situation where we see the costs we may have seen without any wisdom or mindfulness or path or structure or something to hold our desire, if it goes wherever it wants to go in the world and acts out whatever impulse is there, it's not always a great prospect, is it? Very often not. You know, so we sometimes then hear the Buddha's teaching and go, yeah, he's right. I get it. Okay, I get it. And dependent on how we hear that and what our history has been with desire. And also, you know, we might look around the world and say, God, this world is crazy. Not everyone, but this predicament that we face in the world right now, collectively, environmentally, you know, we can see that our unchecked desire and greed is a major generating factor in what's happening. And so we might say, yes, yeah, so not only did the Buddha say it's not okay, I can see the effects in the world. I know I'm kind of tangled in that thing. And we may have had our own experiences in our history where our desire either we acted it out and got punished for it, or either we acted it out and eventually got disappointed because the thing we wanted so much turned out not to do it for us in the end, or we wanted something so much, but we never got it, or we got frustrated or disappointed, or we were told not to want things, or we were told, you should want things, you should have everything you want. Probably not that. But we might take on a worldly culture, oh yeah, I'm supposed to, well, wanting is good, no, wanting is bad. And we can be very confused with this. And in fact, one analysis I really appreciate describes the current world crisis, earth crisis, as a crisis of misplaced desire. Which I really like, because, you know, we might think, okay, if I just don't want anything, then I'm not going to contribute and impact this impossible predicament that we're in. Maybe I should just not want anything, because wanting's what's causing all this trouble. But if you've ever tried not wanting anything, my experience of going however far down that road of that extreme I tried, I was really rather blunt with it. I was really rather, okay, no wanting. Ajahn Sucitto, who now wears a robe because he's a monk, he talks about, he's sort of making a joke about English schools, I think, but you can translate if there's anything related here. And he's talking about, we have school uniforms, and he sort of makes this gesture with a belt, like you've got a belt around your middle. He goes, first they shut you down here, and then we wear a tie, girls and boys, and he goes, and then they shut you down here. Right. But as he also says, I mean, he doesn't make this gesture with the belt, maybe that's why he likes wearing a robe now, but he says, yeah, open up the belly center, you know, so we become present in the belly center, the seat of our libidinal force, our sexuality, which for good reason we may have had to move away from, or, you know, our multiple histories with that, whatever they are. He says, yeah, opening up the belly center, important. He says, if we don't open up the belly center, where this can generate a lot of life force, not opening up the belly center is a road to dullness, right? We don't have the energy that supports and brightens the whole citta. He said, but opening it up without wisdom is a giddy ride. Right? We need wisdom, so. So depending on what we want for our path, or what we sense is possible for us, we do well to study desire, and study craving, and look deeply to discriminate further this whole territory of desire. Really study it. If we want for our path, just a little bit more ease, which is great. You're completely welcome. If we just want just a little bit more ease in our life, then we can think of studying desire a little bit, and craving, because craving will be tangled up in our dis-ease. If we want more from our path, or we sense more is possible, we feel called to more beyonds, then we need to study desire and craving more. And I'm not making them synonymous at this point. That's one first discrimination to make. Right? Nothing happens without desire. To call it all craving would be too gross, would be too unsophisticated. If we, as one woman, I remember speaking to her in a group interview, she was kind of opening, there was a lot of energy and was a lot to her. I said, what do you want? And she said, I want everything. And then she goes, oops, I'm not supposed to want everything. Bad talk, you know. And I said, no, wait, wait. She goes, I want everything. And, you know, we could really easily, blimey, you know, look at the state of the world. I better not be another one that wants everything or putting it down, or that's going to get me into trouble, or I'm in a Dharma center, I'm not supposed to want everything. Or I should want everything, it's good to want everything. You know, whatever binaries and seesaws we go on. I said, no, if you stop with that, just let yourself want what you want. Just sense that heart saying, I want everything. From the perspective of Dhamma, it does not mean we have to then go get that thing and go and seek and grasp, because that can soon turn into that narrowing and shrinking and collapsing and tightening and controlling and trying to keep and then disappointment, etc., etc. But neither does it mean putting it away. And as she let herself just to say that and sense that right through her, her heart visibly became radiant. Her body's presence filled out. And when we explored it more, she said, I don't want everything. I want what I feel called to in this world. I want to serve in the ways I want to serve. I want to open to dhammas I haven't opened to. I want to explore this mystery. I want to serve what I feel called to serve. So we don't have to literalize our desires or concretize the image we have of what they ought to be. And as we practice Dharma, we can free up and start to trust more, actually, that we can handle our fire. We can discriminate. And so if we want everything, then we need to study desire and craving and discriminate it deeply, thoroughly, fully, right through our bones, through our fabric, through our heart, through our belly, through our way we see the other, through the way we open to the world. Really study the subtlest forms of craving to the grossest, most obvious kind of ones, like the image of Gollum. Right? Really study that. And study that doesn't just mean from the top down. Study means from the ground up. Right, that we study, we're right in there where the mindfulness and the investigation and the wisdom and the discrimination are right there, not separate from the arising of the force and the fire and the love. And sometimes desire is not like a big blazing fire. You know, sometimes if we've put our desire away, I mean, we'll have different kinds of ways our desire shows up. But if it's been put away, sometimes when it comes back online, if we allow it, it comes as a very intense force. Sometimes it's not because it's pushing up against the barrier. Sometimes some people just like seem to burn on gas mark 9 or 10. Do you have gas marks here? Do you call it that?
Not really.
What do you call it? Electricity mark 250. You know, so we're...
Is it a lot or a little?
Oh, okay. Gas mark 9's really a lot. But some, you know, some are really passionate and deep, but you'd never see it from the outside. You'd never know it. They're not all fireworks. And it might be a deep, deep, slow burn. So we can't necessarily tell or judge another with regard to that. So we do well to study that too, not assume it looks like something in particular. Oh, if I had my desire properly, I'd be kind of really expressive. Maybe not. And being really expressive doesn't necessarily mean you've got your desire. It could be acting out. Right? So really, really study, study deeply, looking, discerning, loving, if we're interested to love what we love. serve what we want to serve. So studying craving, that's different from desire, and we could delineate desire in many ways. It's a kind of desire. It's a kind of desire that if you study it, you feel that it doesn't feel good. In the body, it's tightening, there's a contraction, there's a desperation in it, the whole instrument of what we are. Comes out of and away from the timeless refuge. And starts to narrow and be bound in time of what must happen, should happen, has to happen, or what's never going to happen, won't happen, not for me, in these narrow bands. So if you are someone, actually, if you are someone, it's worth studying desire. Whoever you are, I recommend it. And you are, we're here, you have to. Because millions of times in the day, there's that impulse, you know, I desire to get out of here, right? Oh, you know, I would be surprised if there's not more than, I don't know, 5 of you who haven't had that thought this week. Is that the right way of saying it? I suspect most of us may have had that thought this week as a desire in a certain kind of way. I want. I'm going to go out and see if there's any. Maybe there's more of that pudding there. That really nice crumbly stuff with the apples and the. And we're in here and it's the sitting. Maybe they left some out. Maybe it's in the kitchen. Maybe I can sneak in. Maybe I'll sneak into the kitchen because now, maybe 3 in the morning, probably no one's going to see that. And there we are. We've lost the here and now. We've lost any. It's like, it's dukkha, isn't it? Really? It's really dukkha. And on retreat, we see that it's really dukkha because there's not really any way around it. It's really dukkha. So if we want to study this to serve deeply what we want to serve, there's many, many factors we need. But the seed factor for this study of desire, because it's not just to sort of read about it in a book study, as you know, is what could be considered the seed factor for all the other factors of the beautiful factors of mind that will come online to serve what we want to serve in this life. When that service is not just the service of myself. Right? We can be included. It's not about trying to have some idealized view of selflessness. We are included, but it's not intended or for my glory or my comfort. And that seed factor is mindfulness. Sati in Pali. Sati, the seed factor out of which all the others can come. So I want to look a little bit at ways that your sati might get limited or lost when sati gets lost. Because sati is not the same as attention. We can be attentive to something and not be mindful. That might really be obvious intellectually to you, but I think it moment to moment, is it actually always really obvious to you that attention, when our attention is given to something, doesn't necessarily mean we're mindful. It can be either compulsive attention, or it can just be attention that's kind of parked in a spot, revving its wheels. I'm kind of there, but it's not actually mindfulness. So I want to look a little bit closer at this. And as I read the A list of places that sati can get lost, mindfulness can be lost. This isn't about judging yourself or ticking off, oh shit, yeah, there and there. This is about just thinking. It's like, oh yeah, I never thought about it like that. Wow. Okay, there's a place I've never looked. There's an arena where I've never thought about my mindfulness not being here, because it felt kind of mindful. So let's. I want to offer this because I find it really, really helpful. And it's one that you can sometimes, if you're a little stuck or you're sort of pushing against something or you're just like, is sometimes to consider, where might the sati be being lost here? So one place the mindfulness is lost is we lose fluency, malleability, flexibility. Attention latches on to something, right? It's like it parks in a spot, or it latches on to the pain in my knee, and I think I must have spent hours on the meditation cushion thinking I was mindful, actually locked into my knee pain. You know, maybe that was necessary. But actually, it may not be mindfulness. There may be attention, but mindfulness will come together with other factors. So yeah, listen to the lesson, you'll see where. We lose fluency, we might become fixated and obsessed, right? Anyone not been fixated and obsessed at least for half a minute about a phenomenon this week? Either a thought, it's not necessarily always an obvious conceiving obsession, which is the more obvious way we think about obsession, where you're kind of locked in and it's like, mm-hmm. It can be, there will also be conceiving, but more subtle. I might be locked in to, I might become really lose fluency because I'm locked into attending to my heart or an emotion, let's say. But I've become rigid in it. I've become a little rigid in it. It's like locked down and rigid, parked there. And when we notice that, we can kind of back out of that parking space and actually open the attention to something else, to free up the attention. So a gathered attention is not a locked or a rigid attention. And you don't have to think that, oh, blimey, I've wasted all week. You know, it's like these things, we can't just know them from here. It's like we have to get into the playing field, get messy, get dirty. In a way, get our hands dirty, and it's like, oh yeah, that's actually really different when my attention is locked down on something. Even in the name of meditation, right? Even in the name of meditation, there I am, paying attention. Second place, we can lose, the here and now. So this is the situational awareness that I'm operating in. So a classic example, we're kind of in a dream. We sort of think we're being mindful, but I remember like thinking I was mindfully offering metta phrases, you know, may you be on a long metta retreat, may I be happy, may you be happy, may you be safe and protected. Kind of lost in a dream and they're sort of operating here, these phrases, and I'm kind of like, those phrases are going like that. And then I sort of completely forget, you know, where I am and what's going on. Classic example in the paper, you see it probably, you might have done it, you're on your mobile phone. Was the story of a woman, I think, in Singapore on her mobile phone, lost the situational awareness and walked straight into a fountain, right? She didn't die, so it can be funny. She didn't hurt herself. But it's that, we kind of lose the situational lateral sense of things. Right. So, or I remember Michelle MacDonald Smith, a lovely teacher at IMS, she said it in a public talk, so it's okay to say it. I think that's okay. I think that's ethically okay. I think so, because I'm Dharma Seed. And she said she was doing samatha practice and really, right, paying attention to the breath. And she got her soup at lunchtime. She came back to her table at somewhere. Mindful, attentive. She put her soup on her chair and stood between the chair and the table. tense sensing, breathing, pulled in the chair, sat down. That's an example of it. You get the gist. You might think, phew, I'm not that daft. But, you know, because she was really giving herself to something. You know, so something is being cultivated, but something else is missing. She hasn't got the whole picture yet. You can lose, number three, you can lose the body. You can lose the embodiment really easily. In this sense, it means being oblivious, not knowing what's going on in this whole somatic, like the whole soma of the body, not knowing what's going on there. You know, not even sensing. And sometimes, like, there can be a human gift in that, in the sense of, like, athletes training to, you know, not be sort of too assailed by certain painful sensations that would come. But from this perspective, we're not knowing what's happening in the soma. So even signals like hunger, and some of us may know this and have it, signals of pain, there's a kind of a loss of reference to the soma. And not just pain and difficulty or signaling, but also realms, whole realms that the soma can open up when our mindfulness saturates the whole bodily field. Right, so we can lose the embodiment. On a sort of human level, we can lose the alarm signals of the body. You know, and you might think, oh, I don't know this one. You know, sometimes I know someone, I have a friend who, I think it is conditioned from an earlier experience of not recognizing their own hunger signals. You know, when hunger has not been attended to, for example. Yeah. So that would be one end of the extreme, and we can go further to learn to ignore the soma out of necessity or survival, or we might just be missing it out of habit in practice. Fourth place, we might lose space. So this we've talked about a bit at the beginning. The mindfulness and the attention can collapse, can shrink, can narrow onto a very small aspect. So this is the other side of it parking in something, where we've lost fluency, we've lost space. We've lost the sense of spaciousness of space, what's more than the object. Mindfulness, sati, doesn't narrow down on an object. It can have an object. It can have an object that it's attending to, a pain, a thought, an emotion. It can have an object. But it has also a wider field around it. It has a periphery and a center. It has a whole field, and it can include everything. Right, but it may choose to offer its attention to one spot. Right, without shrinking the space. That's a really interesting one, I think, you know, especially if we've learned a concentration or we've tried to do a concentration that just hones in on one spot. You can too, so absolutely do such a concentration. But you don't have to lose the space. You don't have to lose the slightly more than field. You can lose... Here's a thing that I think to... You know, I'll still want to pay attention to, but really one I didn't consider for a long time. You lose the other of your fellows. You lose the horizontal human realm. Doesn't mean you have to focus on us all the time. It means you have the sense that you're all alone in there. You're all alone in this little bubble called my meditation. And it can feel lonely and if you notice that, it's like open out the attention, just remember. Doesn't mean you have to go to them with your attention. It means you remember. You're not alone here, as a human, as a practitioner. Really important. And lastly, I'll include, we can lose our embeddedness, being embedded in something more than us. Right? So that might be the very obvious roots in our homage and connection to Earth as Earth, as matter, right? The more than us of the planet, the more than us of the sky, of the trees, of the water, right? Embedded in what's more than us. And it can include being embedded and rooted in what is more than us that may not be so obvious. Dimensions and dimensions that can open up in our practice that are more than our conception of ourself, that we can also be rooted in. You know, that's a really interesting one, that last one. I think that's kind of one of the modern ailment of that loss of embeddedness in more than us. The conception and the idea, if we look at our European history from, I mentioned the other night, that European Enlightenment, and particularly in the Protestant Revolution, where the individual starts to ascend in a very particular way. A beautiful, necessary, important, but one of the costs can be the embeddedness on a more, may not be, doesn't have to be, but where that's gotten developed and taken further beyond the religious context into a way where the individual has to do it themselves. Whatever it is, no God, sort out their livelihood, make it. And if you think, oh my goodness, all six, all weak, I doubt that. It's not like we suddenly have to perfectly situate ourselves, right? Right, let me just check. Have I got my fluency? Have I got my body? Have I got the others? Have I got the space? Have I got the sky? Have I got dimension? Blimey. Right? No, it's not like that. It doesn't mean whatever we've been missing means that our practice hasn't gone anywhere. You know that where it's gone. You know what it's touching for you and opening up for you. But I think this list is useful to consider when we might be feeling limited, or when we're just ready for an appraisal, like our practice has got a little stagnant or stuck, then to just have a look. It's like, okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, I keep forgetting there's other human beings. I'm just so in my thing. Okay, what happens? Let me just lightly, very lightly include that. Not sure I like it. Was better before. Right? You can just watch, you know, just track and watch what happened. What did she mean anyway? Do I have to like them? No, you don't have to like them. Just the acknowledgement. It's almost like your energy body, your sense is just acknowledging. And you can still be at the center, not something self-centered. You can still be the focus, but the periphery, the field, the whole field is lightly acknowledged. In fact, you might just sense that. You might really easily be doing that anyhow. But let's just practice that a bit. You don't have to shut your eyes or change your posture or anything. But just sense your own embodiment, your own backside on the seat. You're still at the center there. You, in your unique coordinates in the cosmos. Yeah, you're still unique in that. You're coming together of your desire and your history and everything that's made you you and your sense of possibility and our ancestors and the culture and the dimensions and the love of what we want to serve. The knowledges that you have in only the way that you know them. At the center and lightly opening your awareness without, you don't have to lose yourself in that. You don't have to dissolve in that field. Your integrity, you can, that's one thing that can happen, but you can be at the center and the field is wide. And just see what that's like to breathe there with the earth below. And sense that weight dropping into that earth below. Giving your weight back, relinquishing yourself, not maybe having to work so hard or fret so hard. It will also really serve with our desire to be plugged into a bigger circuit board than this little packet called me. Breathing out and breathing in. You can still be at the center, and your breath can be at the center, and even your precision to the detail can be at the center. But you don't have to shrink. You don't have to tighten. And when we do, we can care for that. So letting your body breathe, maybe not having to work so hard. Your desire to be here and the desire that calls you to new frontiers. Of maybe meditative knowing, maybe human knowing, maybe ethical knowing, maybe something you can't describe. Let yourself sense through your midline your desire that brings you here, that is yours, but it's more than yours. You can't really say it's yours, but it's not somebody else's. Breathe with your chest. And if you wish, breathe and pay homage to that spark or that fire. Whether it's gas mark 9 or 1. Sensing what has called you this week, where new frontiers have shown themselves to you. Whether that's something lovely or difficult, doesn't matter. It's following that calling that lets us know we're on track. Breathing with your chest, sensing that, what is calling you this week. Doesn't have to be on a Buddhist map. I don't know how you would describe it or paint it or sing to it or keep very quiet about it. Sensing yourself, whatever it is that wakes up in you every morning. And it's there again. Your life. Your spark. Some. Willingness. To keep going. Maybe some spark to know more. And I offer you two things to end. This is, and keep sensing yourself, see where this may or may speak to you. This is from a physicist called Carlo Rovelli. He says, there are frontiers where we are learning, and our desire for knowledge burns. They are in the most minute reaches of the fabric of space, at the origins of the cosmos, in the nature of time. In the phenomenon of black holes, and in the nature of your own thoughts. Here, on the edge of what we know, in contact with the ocean of the unknown, sometimes that's what happens on the edge of the unknown. Excuse me. Here, on the edge of what we know, in contact with the ocean of the unknown, shines the mystery and beauty of the world, and it is breathtaking. Daring to let ourselves want what we want. We can discriminate what is unskillful, what is not ethical, what may harm another. But we don't have to push down our desire for fear that it can only come to no good. We learn to study and discriminate to allow that which looks like my desire to root in what is more than us and let it be in the service of what we love. And I finish with this another poem from Rumi, two nights in a row, because he seems to have a few things to say about passion. Passion burns down every branch of exhaustion. Passion is the supreme elixir and renews all things. No one can grow exhausted when passion is born. Don't sigh so heavily, your brow bleak with boredom and despair. Look for passion, 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 passion. Futile solutions deceive the force of passion. They are given to extort money through lies. Marshy and stagnant water is no cure for thirst, no matter how limpid and delicious it might look. It will only stop and prevent you from looking for fresh rivers that could feed and make flourish 100 gardens, just as each piece of false gold prevents you from recognizing real gold and where to find it. False gold will only cut your feet and bind your wings, saying, I will remove your difficulties, when in fact it is only dregs and defeat in the robes of victory. So run, my friends, run fast and furious from all false solutions, and let divine passion triumph and rebirth you in yourself. Run, my friends, fast and furious from all false solutions, and let divine passion triumph and rebirth you in yourself. Okay, let's sit for a minute.